to welcome everyone tonight. I'll take a motion to approve the June 3rd minutes.
So moved.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Okay, I'm going to pass those around. And what I'd like to do, if there are no objections, is to take the sheriff's resolutions, resolution 291 and 295, first before we talk about the safe harbor program. Do I need a motion to approve that, or can I just go ahead and
do
it?
No, you can do whatever you want.
Okay, so let's begin with, if there are no objections, resolution 291. And this is a contract in excess of 50,000 Visual Computer Solutions. Do we have a motion to consider?
Move.
Second.
This is to extend an agreement for support and maintenance of the police corrections officer scheduling software.
That's our scheduling, and it also taxes our payroll.
And your pay.
For the interaction with the county.
Fairly important stuff.
Is it based on a swipe card or a punch number? Or?
No. For the criminal division, they're assigned, and then it's verified by the supervisor that the member has made that attendance, whether it's an 8 a.m. to 4 p.m. shift, part-time or special deal, and it's placed on the computer in a calendar format. Once it's worked, it goes over the payroll and it's processed for their pay.
Other questions? All in favor?
Aye.
Jonathan. And this is 295. This is another contract that has to do with inmate telephone services. A motion to consider?
Motion.
Check.
Jonathan?
So, and I apologize, I just kind of really got looking into this contract today, so if there's any information, you know, I'll connect with you guys in the, you know, following time. But I do have a few questions, you know, regarding this issue, you know, especially because this company is one of the largest of the, I think, what I was reading, two telecommunication companies that specialize in prison communications. And I noticed that based on, this is a new contract with a new company. We had previously been with the company we're with now, which is the other, you know, major company, but based out of California, not Texas. My first question, I have a couple, is what was the reason for the change going a new, you know, with a new company?
Some of the issues were the tablets the inmates were using,
mm-hmm.
where they weren't well supported.
Mm-hmm.
They're real popular, and it's a good tool for them for learning, but it's also a good tool for behavior,
mm-hmm.
with those tablets. One of the things that we also looked at and was discussed with the sheriff and with the county exec's office and with the legislative chair was the cost for the inmates.
Mm-hmm.
So our past contract was 21 cents a minute for the inmates to utilize the phone. With Securus, they brought that down to 14 cents a minute. So that was actually a pretty good savings. And they also included a better tablet program.
I will say that the former contract was just signed by our former sheriff,
mm-hmm.
was not done through contract management or the county attorney's office, and in fact, the former county attorney, B, had tried to cancel that contract,
mm-hmm.
And basically we were told, we'll see you in court, and so she didn't continue on, but now that that contract has,
mm-hmm.
the term has expired, I know the sheriff's looked at going another route.
Contract management, your office as well.
Right.
Yeah,
so it was an RFP.
Yeah, and that number, you know, those were exactly the numbers I was looking for, the difference in the charge to inmate, and I'm happy to see that number go down.
And you might, we quite possibly will be the lowest in the state.
Okay, that's really good. And yeah, and I was very interested, and I think they went into, you know, good detail explaining the tablet program and what actual, you know, services they offer, and they seem like the customer support is definitely there, I mean, throughout the contract. Another just small question I had, and I didn't see it in the Schedule A, but I didn't know if it was I was missing somewhere. There's recently been some, you know, articles about this company and other companies entering into contracts with county facilities where essentially they create a database of voice fingerprints where they're able to take that recording of the voice and then they develop a database which essentially they can voice identify almost like a fingerprint but by voice. And that has brought up some concerns from you know, attorneys and other places where a lot of times in the county jail, these are pre-trial detainees. They haven't been charged with, they haven't been convicted of a crime. And then what happens is that there's this database, and even if the case is dismissed, they're found not guilty in those situations, this company now maintains that database. And the only way for that voice fingerprint and that data to be removed just through an actual expungement of that specific record. I didn't see that specifically outlined in this contract, but I wasn't sure if that was a practice that was being utilized.
So as for an investigative feature for the phones, it allows data to be shared between other facilities that have the same interactive features. But what it's detecting is three-way calling, you know, similar numbers,
yep.
Search by keywords.
Yep.
In a conversation, someone's name.
Okay.
If they say a type of drug, if they say escape, so keywords.
Yeah. So that.
Other than that, the data that's collected.
You're not going that far.
Voice recognition.
Yep. Thank you. I appreciate that. I'm good.
Other questions? All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Thank you.
So let's turn our attention then to the Safe Harbor program and give you opportunity to introduce yourself and tell us a little bit about the program. Thank you for coming.
Thank you for the invitation. I was saying to Mark that normally the conversations that I've had around the Safe Harbor program have been with the Health and Human Services Committee, because as a Department of Social Services program focused on youth, they're the committee that most generally oversee all of our activities. So a little bit of background, and I'll try to do this in a reasonably short amount of time, and if I do raise any issues that anyone has questions about, just interrupt me. I'd be happy to answer those. The Safe Harbor program has its origins with the New York State Office of Children and Family Services, and it arises from federal legislation, which is the Strengthening Families and Preventing Sex Exploitation of Children Act. New York State OCFS was required to begin to implement programming around ensuring that all county Department of Social Services screened all of the youth who we engage with to determine whether or not they might be involved in any type of trafficking activity. Now, we achieve that through our connection systems. And I'm going to try to keep this a little bit basic. I know some Health and Human Services legislatures might be familiar with some of the mechanisms that we use to track our information, but the connection systems is also a New York State system where we basically put all of our records and information about all of the children we encounter. So the connection systems requires that we screen every children, we're mandated to do this, for whether or not there's any trafficking activity happening. If the screening determines that there has been enough activity, that will trigger a referral. And then there will be a comprehensive assessment that will be completed by our staff to determine if there is any kind of significant trafficking. And then we basically arrive at taking that activity and whatever the other underlying activity, which would include any type of abuse or neglect, to arrive at treatment plans that are going to address those issues and trauma. In every real regard, the trafficking of youth is really child abuse. And that's why this has its origins in Health and Human Services. And it hasn't necessarily been something that law enforcement and public safety has been involved in, but obviously there's law enforcement dynamics and public safety concerns. So as a result of the implementation of the federal legislation in 2014, Preventing Sex Trafficking and Strengthening Families Act, I ended up contacting OCFS to see what their plans were around programs, and they had developed the Safe Harbor Program. And we actually were one of the first counties to join the Safe Harbor Program in 2015. It's a 5-year program, and we're in our fifth and final year of the program. And I think that that's compelling to the degree that it demonstrates how complicated this subject matter is. A lot of state pilot programs last a year or two, and the funding streams that are attached to them also last a year or two. Mm-hmm. And then the counties who have participated in those programs have to make difficult decisions around continuing funding streams and sustainability. So one of the things that really attracted me to getting on board with Safe Harbor early was the 5-year time frame. I thought to myself, this is really going to be complicated subject matter. OCFS is making a 5-year commitment, and we're really going to be able to make a difference with this. The OCFS Safe Harbor program really has three basic cornerstones: awareness, education, and training. And then it basically evolves into service provision. So over the course of time, that was the approach that we took. Each county is given autonomy and flexibility about how to implement the Safe Harbor program. It's a bell curve funding, which in the first year was around $90,000, second year $110,000, third year $120,000, fourth year back down to $110,000, fifth and final year we're getting about $90,000. So that bell curve funding really also dictated, what are we really going to be able to accomplish? And with a lot of the programs that come into the Department of Social Services, we try to make decisions around, should we do this in-house? Should we basically look to service providers, or should we do it via independent contractors? I felt that the unique nature of this subject matter really required focus, and we started at the outset with a combination of an independent contractor to coordinate the program, and we used Family of Woodstock during the first year as a service provider. And I really wanted to have two things going on at the same time. My goals were to have awareness, education, and training done by a coordinator, but I wanted to start to develop service provision around some of the kids who were in our population or came into our care and custody who we identified had been trafficked. And we started to begin to find, and I'm grateful that I was uniquely positioned because of the 20 or so years I had already spent at DSS as an attorney prosecuting cases, I knew we had trafficking. I knew we had children in households being sexually exploited, in some cases by their relatives or other people in the circle of their community, and yet trafficking really hadn't taken on the kind of profile that it has now. And one of the things that we like to do in our presentation is we have a myths and facts section. And we try to dispel some of the myths around the movie Taken, that trafficking happens everywhere. And it also happens to people that are born, raised, and never leave the borders of Ulster County. A lot of that is technology driven and the sophistication and manipulation of the predatory people who are trafficking individuals. Our geographic location in the state also lends itself because of the major highways that we have coming through our area. And trafficking operations are often very mobile. They'll set up in one location for a period of time. And then it's also uniquely situated with the Department of Social Services because data from the federal government that originally funded this program demonstrated that the population that is really most vulnerable is the foster child population. The foster child population normally comprises children that have already suffered some type of trauma due to neglect or abuse, are having difficulty with permanency, maybe in congregate care facilities, maybe moving around from foster homes or relative foster homes. So their susceptibility to potentially being manipulated or exploited by sophisticated traffickers is greater. And the harsh realities are that, notwithstanding the effort we expend, we do have children that go AWOL from their placements, whether it's foster care placements, congregate care placements, and we know while they're AWOL, they become vulnerable to being victimized by people who are seeking to exploit them. So that's a really another important dynamic in this whole conversation. So I think the realization that this program became available back in 2015, that it was timely, that it was necessary, is why we participated, why we wanted to launch the program, which we did. And then the second phase, after awareness, education, and training, started to really kind of organically develop into prevention education, really reaching the youth population. And in as much as we have a lot of excellent contractual arrangements with Family of Woodstock, I found that the subject matter and my expectations around what I wanted to see being done were not really being accomplished. They do a lot of terrific programs with youth. We know so many of their programs. We talked about one earlier during the Health and Human Services Committee meeting. We know about the Single Independent Living Program. We know about 180. We know about all these kinds of things they're doing, but I wasn't really feeling like we were getting the return. So in 2016, I decided to look to another independent contractor to be our prevention educator. So there could be real focus on a lot of the materials you've seen here. The brochures, the billboards, the appearances on radio, the outreach, the visits to the schools, the events we convene, really trying to reach the youth, developing the youth guide. We have a Southern Youth Guide and a Northern Youth Guide, talking about the resources, starting to really get the conversation generating around this population. Because we all know that kids are exposed to a variety of different dynamics. We know about bullying. We know there's been steps taken on that. We know about mental illness and isolation. We know about alienation. We know that there's sexting that's going on. And we know that there's also sextortion. And we know that at this age, children in our communities and in our schools are involved in having to navigate through a lot of these situations. So our prevention education program really focused on trying to pick subject matter that would help them. And we start off with foundations around healthy relationships. We go into cyberbullying. We go into sexting. And this is something that we've been able to visit many schools, Ellenville, Saugerties, Rondout, Onteora, Kingston. And we've been at it, again, since 2015. So at this point in time, we've reached the place where we're really also focused on sustainability. OCFS wants to see a county arrive at some type of sustainability. What we're hoping to do is create a position potentially through Office of Victim Services grant and our ongoing Safe Harbor grant to have something in the Crime Victims Assistance Unit that will continue to do this work around coordinating training, awareness, and education events, and also do service provision. I think our long-term goals have made it possible for us to arrive at this place. I think many of you are familiar with our Interagency Council on Domestic Violence. That's been a council that's been in effect since, I want to say, 2009. In my capacity as Commissioner of Social Services, I chair that council. We've done many events over the past years that I've been chairing it. One of our higher profile events is we do Domestic Violence Information Forum in October, which is Domestic Violence Awareness Month. So last year, in connection with sustainability, we decided to expand that council to also include human trafficking. So it is the Interagency Council on Domestic Violence and Human Trafficking. And this past January, which is End Human Slavery and Human Trafficking Awareness Month, we started to begin to have a trafficking awareness forum. So we had an event in January, very well attended, very well received, part of our sustainability plan. So going forward, I feel like over the past 5 years, we've made great accomplishments in regards to this area. We do work closely with law enforcement when circumstances warrant it. Some of the very unique principles around engaging youth who are being trafficked involve that we kind of step back and treat those youth differently. Many of them don't even realize or perceive they're being trafficked. They think that they're in a healthy relationship with someone who's exploiting them, and they're offended at the prospect. that they're being identified as having been being prostituted or trafficked, and yet they know that deep down they may be being manipulated and exploited. So that's been something that just principles around engagement include: not blaming, not judging, accepting the youth where they are. Dealing with law enforcement has been challenging sometimes because law enforcement frequently perceives these youth as reckless, promiscuous, troublemaking, involved in other criminal activity. But we've made great strides. In our county, I'm happy to say that I very rarely see anybody referring to a child as a prostitute. There's no such thing as a child prostitute. That goes to capacity of being able to consent to having sex. Any child that is being trafficked who is under 18 is being raped, is what it really boils down to. And the harsh reality is that communities like ours and throughout the state that are rural in some regard have some difficulty understanding some of these concepts and recognizing that trafficking is going on in our communities. But again, we've gone about it, you know, in a candid, thoughtful way to raise awareness and to educate our professionals and to make sure that our service response is meeting the needs that are being identified and to do a lot of prevention education. So I think at this point, again, we're at a really great place. I'm also very happy to report from a fiscal point of view, because funding streams are always very important, we have not had to invest one county dollar in this program over the 5 years. In as much as we have exceeded our grant allocation every year, many other programs throughout the state have not used all of theirs. So we have been able to claim for the amounts that we exceeded our grant allocation. I'm always thoughtful to budget a small amount based on what I think we might exceed our grant. But because other counties haven't really been able to get a foothold on it, there's been available funding that we have been able to access. And my expectation is that going forward this year, we'll be in a similar position. I'm also happy to report that regionally, we've been a regional leader in terms of convening conferences and events and bringing in guest speakers and participating in events that are being held by other organizations. We have spoken at the New York Public Welfare Association conferences. We have spoken at the Safe Harbor Summits. We have appeared and spoken to many teaching organizations. So I think it has been an incredibly successful program, and there's been a lot of awareness. Just this year and most recently, we've done presentations to Catholic Charities, to the Boys and Girls Club. We've gone into the hospitals and the emergency rooms and healthcare providers. We're constantly expanding our profile around this issue. It has been a program that I've personally monitored and overseen and supervised, and I think, again, it had to do with the fact that I had a unique understanding around it and knowing that it was going on with our population. So we've worked very closely with the LGBTQ Center, and they've been a strong partner. So I think we're in a really strong place, and our sustainability program will also contemplate and be prepared to help adult victims of human trafficking. We have helped many adult victims of human trafficking over the past few years. There are specific programs through the Office of Temporary and Disability Assistance that are designed to do that, and we have actually been a safe harbor for adults who have been identified in other regions of the state, who have been transported to Ulster County for their safety, where we have helped to process them to be able to return to safe locations. Some have remained here and been assimilated into our community and had their documentation and employment issues addressed. So consistent with what has been the philosophy in Ulster County of embracing and engaging persons that are vulnerable and need, we've already done that. And, you know, I think it's important. I think it's part of our core mission. It's been something that we properly have had responsibility for the subject matter. And, you know, as devastating as it is to acknowledge that it's happening, it's also very important that we're in a place where we're addressing it. We don't focus significantly on the prosecution side. We're a service delivery organization. We're trying to help ease youth and adults transition to places of safety and stability. And sometimes that doesn't consistently make it possible to have law enforcement be involved. And out of respect and consideration for what the consequences could be of involving law enforcement, we try to support decision making around that with the victims and the survivors. I'm very grateful that I've been able to work in this area and help our community arrive at the place that it is. Again, it's subject matter that can be uncomfortable. I think we've made great strides. I'm happy to report we've trained over 3,700 professionals in Ulster County, including DSS, law enforcement, medical, school administration, service providers, PTA, churches, Rotary clubs. We've had a numerous amount of events, many renowned guest speakers. What's still remarkable to me is probably not a week goes by that I still meet someone who hasn't heard about it. Most recently, in conversations with a colleague of all of ours who works in the Youth Bureau and the Human Rights Commission, and was interested in making sure that this was something that we were working on, had a phone call. Do you know anything about this? I said, how much time do you have? I know a lot about it. And this person, Nina Dawson, was under the impression that we weren't doing anything. And I spent about an hour educating Nina about everything we had done, which is not a reflection on Nina or the program. I think it's a reflection of how much information and subject matter there constantly is out there. And she was very encouraged to know how involved and informed and expert we were on it. And a month later, we did an event together at the Boys and Girls Club. So to the degree that there's always new opportunities to educate individuals and organizations and have events, and that it's something that I'm working very hard on to make sure we arrive at sustainability over, I think we're in a great place with it.
So. I think we have a question.
A comment and a question, because my son-in-law just got his CDL, and apparently the Hurley CDL training school there, either that or it's Perico, but they somehow participate, and they said if they see, I don't know, he was kind of tongue-in-cheek, but if a van load of females comes up and is looking to solicit, that there's a certain phone number to call. But do you reunite them with families too? I mean, are you finding that there's immigrants that they've actually brought in from other countries, or is it specifically, you know, within our area? Are they bringing them up from the city? I mean,
it's not limited to that kind of population. Mm-hmm. It's not so much that that's a myth, but it's a perception that it's limited to that population. We're not finding necessarily cases where groups of immigrants or undocumented individuals are being transported to Ulster County. We have had a couple of cases where youth who were born in Ulster County, live in Ulster County, are citizens of the United States, have been identified and victimized and transported out of Ulster County to other locations for purposes of being trafficked. So we're not seeing a large number of cases like you just described. We're also making inroads into labor trafficking, a little bit more challenging, a little bit more difficult. We're working with the New York State Department of Labor. They already have many programs in place around that dynamic. Also very challenging because of cultural and business approaches where you might have youth who grow up in a family business, which is not necessarily trafficking, but may have begun working from a very young age and helped to support their family. So I think that's where you have to be very thoughtful. For children that are in our care and custody, which is the bulk of the kids that we have identified as having been trafficked, whether or not reunification is arrived at is part of their larger treatment plan and the possibility that reunification can be achieved in a safe way for that child and his or her family. So reunification is always a goal of ours with all of the children in our care. But unfortunately, sometimes that's not feasible. Sometimes we get voluntary surrenders. Sometimes we get conditional surrenders. Sometimes we have to terminate parental rights. So permanency is always really then, and permanency with forever families is what our next goal is. Sometimes that's by reunification. Sometimes it's with a relative. Sometimes it's a foster family. So that's kind of, you know, the range. And we see it across the spectrum of all of the cases that we deal with.
So these materials are, and what you've described, extremely impressive. And I've been fortunate enough to see some presentations at Healthy Ulster Council, and I've been kind of watching this develop. And I think it's something we should be really proud of. I was wondering about two things. One is, can you give some sense of the numbers of clients that you are working with? Because the outreach to the general community is important, but I appreciate some sense of that.
Right.
And also, you talked about gender and how that can come into play. Are there aspects of drug use and addiction that also you bump up against, and how do you handle that?
Okay. With regard to your first question, now this is limited to the youth population. Our data from 2016 to now is that we've had a total number of referrals of 68. So we've had 68 children referred to us that have been screened and identified as potentially having been trafficked. Of those 68, 11 have ended up meeting the specific federal definition. And becoming confirmed as a trafficking victim potentially makes that individual, if they seek to exercise it, eligible for certain kinds of benefits throughout the balance of his or her lifetime. The other persons who have not met the federal definition still are entitled to receive treatment and services and support. So there's some unique criteria around that. So that's the number we've seen. The bulk of those referrals have essentially been through the child welfare system. Although we have gotten some referrals from school systems, from probation, and from the community, and through the state central registry, the SCR reports, sometimes we'll get referrals there. So your question with regard to whether or not we've been able to track and see kind of any correlation between drug use and being involved and being trafficked, you know, yes, we have, but not to the degree that it's always present.
Might be another myth.
I don't want to say it's a myth, because traffickers can certainly be predatory and manipulative enough to encourage a victim to begin to develop a drug habit to control. Very similar to the power and control wheel that you see in domestic violence. There's a lot of intersectionality and overlap. So utilizing drugs as a methodology to exert control over another person is something that we do see in some of the cases. So, but it's not always going to necessarily be present. So, and I think you had another of that. Okay,
yeah.
You had seen that.
Very.
Okay.
It's troubling, as you say, that we, you know, these are very troubling cases to identify, but how much worse not to identify them,
right,
and provide services.
Right. And I think it's probably much the same way that domestic violence still is, although we've made great strides. Decades ago, it was enormously underreported because of fear of reprisal or being rendered unable to get any support. I think that this is dramatically underreported partially because of some of the humiliation or lack of perception that there could be support. You have a lot of youth who identify as what's called gay for pay. So we're very concerned that among the young male population who are at risk or abandoned or trying to get by on their own, this is a very great concern, because it goes against a lot of our cultural expectations of masculinity. And we call the gay for pay moves into the spectrum of survival sex. You know, agreeing to have sex to have your basic needs met of food, shelter, and medical care. So I think in that regard, they really portray with some complicated dynamics. And again, trying to overcome some of these perspectives that it's not recklessness, it's not promiscuity, it's not criminal, it's child abuse is what it really is. So I think that's part of what the challenges that we have faced. And, you know, it's not easy for an administration to to engage and support this, especially one in a county like ours that depends on attracting visitors for tourism and to enjoy all of the beautiful activities that are available here. It's difficult to put up billboards talking about trafficking happens here. But we have to be candid and serious about the fact that the more people that we make aware who are looking out for this, the greater the potential is that we get referrals. So I think that that's been one of the important things that we've been able to accomplish.
I have a few.
Sure.
So you have 68 referrals. I imagine that those referrals don't give us a sense of how extensive the problem is. So I'm wondering if you have other measurement indicators that help us understand, is this really an extensive problem? Is it a significant problem but smaller on the scale?
I always think that when you try to use data to arrive at the scale of a problem, especially where human suffering and exploitation and manipulation and rape and sexual abuse are taking place, that even one,
right,
whether it's one or 68, now all of these children that I'm referring to were also the subject of some other trauma that may or not have been related. They may have been physically abused, neglected, abandoned. So it's another level of trauma. What we do see is that the trafficking usually comes subsequently. Because they've had an underlying trauma that has brought them into our system, and they feel alienated, and they have behavioral difficulties, maybe already involved in substance abuse issues, maybe have behavioral problems, are not able to be reunified with their family, or successfully transition into a permanent foster home or in a congregate care facility, and AWOL from that facility. Mm-hmm. Now they're on their own. Now they have had the underlying trauma, and now they're susceptible to the predators who traffic, who look for kids in malls, at bus stations, and are very sophisticated in their methodologies. Some who persuade and essentially arrive at developing internet relationships and persuade children to meet them someplace, kids that feel isolated. So there's regional information. You can go to the Office of Children and Family Services website and get regional information. I can tell you that since the Safe Harbor program has been implemented in New York State going back to 2014,
yeah,
I want to say, and I don't think this is an exaggeration, that the number of reported cases and confirmed cases has increased by almost 750% statewide.
Right.
So it's gaining momentum.
Right.
You know, teachers, health care providers, you know, social services, human services, they're now looking for it. It's on their radar.
Right.
They're saying to themselves, yeah, well, there's this issue which I clearly know about, but was this also going on? We've had a case where, you know, we've had nuclear families where the biologic parents have been trafficking their children to meet their drug habit.
Yeah. Right.
Now, and those children still want to have a relationship with their parents and don't perceive themselves as having been trafficked.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, the level of trauma is so enormous in situations like that.
Yeah, I mean, it struck me, 68 struck me as a bit, not as a critique of the program,
right,
but it struck me as a bit low in thinking that as I study the problem of sexual trafficking,
right,
I would expect it to be more extensive. But it seems like what you're saying is, probably is, but as our awareness of it grows,
it might begin to increase, right?
Better able to identify,
mm-hmm,
and report.
And we're hoping too the prevention education measures that we're implementing in our community may be successful. We can never know with prevention programs how much do we prevent, because we never see the data on the youth who may have paused to become involved in an unhealthy relationship or reached out to a responsible adult for help.
Yeah.
Rather than become the victim of being trafficked.
It sounds that you see a strong correlation between trauma and that is a kind of conditioning.
A vulnerability.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And again, this is a program with its origins in federal legislation administered through OCFS because of the great vulnerability that children who are in the foster care system have.
Right. And I just have one more question. Yeah, I wonder... You know, you take a very compassionate approach in terms of saying we're here to help the victim, even though traditional law enforcement might see the victim as engaging in criminal activity. Mm-hmm. So I guess my question is more sort of future-oriented. Is there room, especially with the new incoming sheriff or who has a different sort of philosophy about some of these issues, to have law enforcement take a different approach? And are we able to do that without necessarily taking the path of massive, you know, reform in criminal law? Is there, in other words, whenever you're dealing with police, they have some degree of, ability to determine what to do in a situation, mm-hmm. right? And is there a greater opportunity with, new ideas coming in to train police officers to take this more compassionate approach?
I want to say I'm happy to report we were way ahead of the curve.
Okay, that's good.
Paul Van Blarkum's administration was incredibly receptive and hosted many weeks of training at the law enforcement facility when we first rolled this out.
Yeah.
We brought in Chief David Ryan, who's an expert from Pound Ridge, New York, on trafficking. Courtney Albert, who's with an organization, Give Way to Freedom. Law enforcement was actually the first group of professionals that we focused our training on. They have been absolutely terrific. They discontinued arresting and charging youth for prostitution on the rare event that other municipal law enforcement agencies, who we also train through the Police Chiefs Association. So with all due respect to the newly elected sheriff, I do have to say that Paul Van Blarkum, all of the other police chiefs were very receptive, very cooperative. We overturned several cases where youth had been charged with prostitution, and we assisted in investigations against their traffickers. So I don't see it as being an enormous need and at this particular point. It's part of the curriculums that they have, and we have great relationships around that. And I think that that now, raise the age, has only added to that momentum about how youth who are committing crimes are being engaged. So I think, again, it was something that I studied closely when we signed up for the program.
Yeah.
You know, and law enforcement is a critical partner to collaborate with in this, but they're really not the only one, and sometimes their only interaction will be in an initial contact. And then after that, if a youth's uncomfortable or feel his or her safety might be compromised by having to cooperate with an investigation, law enforcement and the district attorney's office have been understanding about that. This is not a law enforcement initiative. This is a human services youth initiative around services and trying to arrive at stability and safety for the children's welfare.
I think I said I had one last question, but I promise this is it's interesting to me, and maybe this is a bit academic, but the discourse has changed. It's no longer prostitution, it's trafficking.
Yeah.
And along with that change in vocabulary, that there's a whole set of different assumptions. And when did that sort of discursive shift occur?
I think it's been happening over the past decade or so, very slowly, but I think it's picking up steam. I try to read as much as I possibly can. I try to look at the editorials in the Sunday paper, and I noticed Alan Chartok, who's a commentator and professor of political science at SUNY Albany and on NPR, writes a weekly op-ed. And he referred to an experience not too long ago and made a reference to a child prostitute. So on my list of things to do, I started an email to Mr. Chartok, and it's a wonderful opportunity to educate him.
Right.
We don't use that terminology, Professor.
Right.
So I hope to have him make some mention of that in a future article. And I'm going to request the opportunity to potentially talk about this subject matter with him, because that's how we affect change. That's what our obligation is as public officials, to educate a community by thoughtful discourse. You know, when you hear somebody say something that's no longer appropriate or accurate, you try to, in a reasonable way, start a conversation with that person about why that's changing and why that's not the case. I mean, I think that was part of what the county executive's executive order did last week. No, but it's ongoing, and it's constant, and, you know, you have to keep your ears open and, you know, take the right approach So, yeah, I do think it's building a lot of momentum. And interestingly, it's a collateral and unintended beneficial consequence of the federal conversation. I mean, whatever your opinion might be with respect to those protocols and programs and policies, it certainly brought a lot of attention to the issue. So I think that, you know, there's opportunity there. And I think we as a county are always looking for those opportunities in the conversations we're having.
I mean, I think you pretty much answered it as part of one of the chairwoman's questions here. But, you know, I know that the sheriff's department in particular has had a really, along with the DA's office, has had a really successful Internet Crimes Against Children program. And I was wondering how your program would fit into that one, because that really targets the traffickers themselves.
Right. Those programs, based on the conversations I've had with the district attorney's office and federal authorities that prosecute, and a lot of the programs that are sting operations to try to engage those predators in conversations or explore referrals, the child pornography criminal statutes and the specific elements that need to be arrived at to be proven are very different from the criminal elements that are involved in a trafficking prosecution, although you can have overlap.
Mm-hmm.
And I think what that becomes is more of a conversation for a prosecuting attorney to decide what their best prospects are for a successful prosecution around conviction. What elements can I clearly demonstrate this individual has committed? What is my evidence best support? Because a lot of child pornography can be arrived at without there ever having been any contact between the victim child and the pedophile or pornographer. So there's, again, the intersectionality, the overlapping around it, but I think that our local law enforcement and district attorney's office are aware of those subtle distinctions. You know, and I mean, one of the cases that we successfully prosecuted that involved an adult male who was trafficking a minor female was arrived at because the minor female was in our care and custody, AWOL from a congregate care facility, was arrived at being found and returned and portrayed to us that she was in a romantic relationship with this individual and deeply in love and would at her first opportunity try to AWOL again. And we had productive conversations around why that was probably not appropriate given what healthy relationships involve and what this person was making her do and what she reported to us. And a lot of, you know, basic activity that would just be egregious and offensive to the reasonable person. Ultimately, this minor girl was unwilling to cooperate in any regard. So consistent with the principles of trying to build trust and engage and keep her safe, we ended up, and this is a story that sometimes amuses me, this adult male predatory, manipulative exploiter who was trafficking this girl actually came to our offices to apply for public assistance benefits, because his source of income was no longer available to him, generating income for him. And he completed a public assistance application where he set forth information that was fraudulent. So we ended up being able to prosecute and arrest him on fraud charges without ever having to involve her. And he ended up being incarcerated for several years, which created a window of opportunity. And I'm happy to report in this one particular case, this minor youth went on to reach young adulthood and, you know, occasionally remains in contact with me via email and, you know, is experiencing a lot of issues and obstacles and problems, but is safe. It has not resumed that relationship. And, you know, that's not perfect. It's not ideal, but it's how we try to transition people. So that's just an example of what we do. Sometimes you, it's like the famous case where Al Capone ended up going to jail for tax evasion, which was probably the least serious crime that he was alleged to have committed.
Right.
Yep. So you be creative. You use what's available to you.
I mean, I understand in domestic violence cases, there were district attorneys who pioneered the development of prosecuting cases where the victims of domestic violence may not have wanted the case to go forward. Is that a pathway one could take in these instances, but
certainly.
You try not to do it?
I think certainly there's that same type of creativity, and you know, you have cases where a victim survivor might not perceive him or herself to be a victim survivor and is unwilling to cooperate, or where they do and they don't want to be re-traumatized.
Right.
Being creative about successfully prosecuting the offender, I think, is, you know, always going to be something that most prosecutors engage in and progressively consider.
I just wanted to ask one point of clarification. So we don't have a human trafficking task force. That is part now of the domestic violence and human trafficking.
Yeah, and I consider it to be, I consider those issues to be so interrelated that most of the individuals that I had identified in our community that would be on a domestic violence council would also be on a human trafficking council.
Okay.
So I think the networking and the conversation that's arrived at is so beneficial, and given the demands, quite frankly, on people's time, I think it's been very worthwhile to be able to bring that together. Prior to last year, we had, as part of the OCFS Safe Harbor program, a trafficking critical team. So we basically discontinued the critical team and added human trafficking to the DV Council, but it is now the Interagency Council on Domestic Violence and Human Trafficking. There's a Domestic Violence Subcommittee, and there's a Human Trafficking Subcommittee.
So just for clarification, as your five-year funding runs out, you have identified other funding streams.
Yeah, as a graduated county, we'll continue to receive an allocation. Again, it's not something that law enforcement and public safety, we haven't looked to law enforcement and public safety for funding, because
it's not,
the dynamics and concepts are really not consistent.
Okay.
There's different goals. So we're looking towards more appropriately related departments and organizations to do that with, thinking that crime victims is the most logical place for that. So that is the plan that I arrived at this point.
Do you have any other? This was really fascinating. I so appreciate you coming in and
You're
taking
very
the time.
Welcome.
It's a, you know, this has been increasingly reported on,
right.
And I'd like to think that we're immune to all that's going on, but to know that you've been studying this and have been attentive to this problem and have succeeded, it sounds like.
And we've really had the autonomy and discretion to be creative around the program parameters. And in the materials that you prepared and distributed, it's a great reflection of some of the materials and how they've evolved. And we've used focus groups and tried to definitely come up with messaging and imagery that youth are responsive to, because we all know that the days of a brochure filled with small print that someone's going to sit down and read over a cup of coffee are long gone. It's an instantaneous generation that needs to absorb information via images and brief messaging.
Yeah.
So our presentations, our PowerPoints, our conversations, I usually go a lot faster than this, but I'm appreciative to be around an audience, notwithstanding everyone here, that's a little bit more in my wheelhouse. But I have, again, it's been a great opportunity to learn a lot about a really compelling subject matter that is clearly part of our mission. I've been happy to be involved in it.
Thank you. I can't thank you enough for coming
You're welcome.
In, especially
yeah,
right before the holidays. So.
I'd be in the office anyway if I wasn't here with the kind of day that we've had. Yeah, sure. Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you all.
Very
okay,
nice
have a great
you.
Holiday.
All right, so we have one other resolution here, resolution number 304, and this is a lease agreement with Community College for Public Safety Training Facility, Department of Public Works.
I'll move it.
Second.
Do we have any discussion?
How do we get to $10?
It's nominal. I mean, no, so I'm
thinking a check.
All right. Oh, how do we get it?
No. How did you just assume? How like, do you? We're just gonna like. Was it
kind of like the token dollar, but with inflation.
Yeah. Okay.
I think it was very similar to the Strive.
It's the smallest contract I've ever approved, I think.
Yeah, because it's an.
Yep. We got the Patriots House for a dollar, so that was cheaper. But I don't know if you were. You weren't here then. So.
Right. But
inflation. Yeah, exactly.
They're going to provide the janitorial services. Great. We provide maintenance. This really gives us an opportunity to get state funding on the project.
Yeah,
sounds great.
I'm going to call the vote. All in favor?
Aye.
Did I make a motion?
Yep.
Thank you. Jay's silently like, yes. Good for you. What would I do without Jay?
What would any of us do without Jay?
Yeah, true.
Oh, right. We have the financial reports. So if anyone would like to take a look at them, you can contact Jay. We're always two months behind.
Yeah, 2 months
behind. So we're always 2 months behind. And, of course, it's coming up on the 4th of July. If there's any events anyone would like to tell us about.
I don't even know of any.
Well, fire raid in Shandaken.
What's that? There's a raid in Shandaken?
Parade in Socrates.
That's
far from my house.
Are we still recording?
Yeah, we're still recording. Wait, is there a party at Heppner's house?
No.
All right, so our next meeting is Monday, August the 5th. Yes?
I've got a couple of questions for Mark Ryder, and it might need more information, so I just want to put them on the table before we adjourn.
Absolutely.
Do you know if County Executive Ryan has any explanation on why he didn't sign the DA's salary increase or the Crimes Against Revenue Program resolutions?
Sure. So the DA raise was just... We have no say in it. It's mandated by the
Nor do
state.
We, but we have to do it anyway.
I understand. Right, it was just he didn't feel like he wanted to sign it coming in, and basically one of his first things. Same with the crimes against revenue is a lot of that going after, it's going after state revenue crimes, which is like welfare fraud, etc., and it's something that we've talked about.
We pay a lot of that out of the county budget too. I don't know. I'm just throwing that out there. I was just. It's not something I'd seen in our previous executive where he would pick and choose what he wanted to sign. So I was just curious as to why.
Right. He's not required to sign everyone. It's like a not a pocket veto, but because it's not vetoing it, it's going back unsigned. It's an option in the charter.
So essentially, but is there meaning in his? In his decision not to sign it, or he feels like it will go into effect anyway. There's simply no need to sign, or is there?
Yeah, I think there was simply no need to sign for those two. That he's not fully supportive. Look, we have to pay the DA.
I'm not supportive of paying the DA more money either. But
I understand
the fine folks in the state legislature have put in the judiciary law, so there's nothing I can do about it.
To the extent to where he could send a message, that was where he wanted to send a message.
We should just start defeating these things then, I guess. I don't know. If we don't necessarily agree with them.
Any sense of why he disagrees with the... I mean, just...
Like, which one?
The DA...
raise?
Yeah.
I don't know that he disagrees with the DA raise, but it's a pretty large...
Unfunded
mandate. I mean, to tie in the DA salary to the highest county court judge. I mean, to give you an example, the DA runs a much larger department, but...
It doesn't reflect cost of living in that area. I mean, there's a lot of elements that it leaves out.
Right. You compare that salary to the salary of the county attorney.
The court judge is different from around the...
$202,000 compared to $117,000. And the district attorney does great work, so...
And they have a good deal. I mean, if you also... What's interesting is that the mandated salary for a public defender and child advocates, which is lumped together, hasn't been increased in 13 years.
Right.
They just don't have as good of a deal built into the judiciary law, Ken said.
I mean, it sucks, but it's part of our job. I don't know. I was just curious if there was any more. And the crimes against revenue, I really don't understand, because that's money that goes right back into the county coffers. But
do you have a sense of why he didn't sign that one?
That it had to do with that. I mean, I think there's a shift in, yes, we need to go after welfare fraud, but I think to the extent that the executive's office is going to put out press releases on it and various different things.
Right.
So
it sounds like he thinks there are other issues that deserve greater focus and priority. Not that that's unimportant.
Right.
Okay.
State grant, though. I mean,
I just wanted to
say, it's a state grant that goes into bringing our own money back. I understand.
I appreciate the clarification.
Mm-hmm.
We kind of pressed you a little bit, but it's good to have that clarification. Any other? Those were great questions.
That's my only questions.
If there are no other questions, I will take a motion to adjourn.
Second. Oh, so moved. Sorry.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Happy 4th of July.
I got a walk-up.